This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Leadership in Turbulent Times by Doris Kearns Goodwin. Read by Beau Bridges, David Morse, J.O. Sanders, and Richard Thomas. With an introduction and epilogue read by the author.
For my husband, Richard Goodwin, and our best man and closest friend, Michael Rothschild. Forward. Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, the lives and times of these four men have occupied me for half a century. I have awakened with them in the morning and thought about them when I went to bed at night. By immersing myself in manuscript collections, personal diaries, letters, oral histories, memoirs, newspaper archives, and periodicals, I searched for illuminating details that, taken together, would provide an intimate understanding of these men, their families, their friends, their colleagues, and the worlds in which they lived. After writing four extensive books devoted to these men, I thought I knew them well before I embarked on this present study of leadership nearly 5 years ago. But as I observed them through the exclusive lens of leadership, I felt as if I were meeting them anew. There was much to learn as the elusive theme of leadership assumed center stage. As I turned to works of philosophy, literature, business, political science, and comparative studies, in addition to history and biography, I found myself engaged in an unexpectedly personal and emotional kind of storytelling. I returned to fundamental questions I had not asked so openly since my days of college and graduate school. Are leaders born or made? Where does ambition come from? How does adversity affect the growth of leadership? Do the times make the leader, or does the leader shape the times? How can a leader infuse a sense of purpose and meaning into people's lives? What is the difference between power, title, and leadership? Is leadership possible without a purpose larger than personal ambition? How fondly I remember long and heated sessions over just such questions with my graduate school friends, arguing through the night with a fervor surpassing our level of knowledge. Yet, at bottom, something in these discussions was exactly on the mark, for they engaged us deeply, tapped our idealism, and challenged us to figure out how we wanted to live our own lives. I realize now that debates such as these put me on the path to find my own calling as an historian. In part one, we see the four men when they first entered public life. In their 20s, when they set forth to forge their public identities, they appear very different from the sober, iconic countenances that have since saturated our culture, currency, and memorial sculpture. Their paths were anything but certain. Their stories abound in confusion, hope, failure, and fear. We follow mistakes made along the way, from inexperience, cockiness, lack of caution, outright misjudgments, and selfishness, and see the efforts made to acknowledge, conceal, or overcome these mistakes. Their struggles are not so different from our own. No single path carried them to the pinnacle of political leadership. Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt were born to extraordinary privilege and wealth. Abraham Lincoln endured relentless poverty. Lyndon Johnson experienced sporadic hard times. They differed widely in temperament, appearance, and physical ability. They were endowed with a divergent range of qualities often ascribed to leadership: intelligence, energy, empathy, verbal and written gifts, and skills in dealing with people. They were united, however, by a fierce ambition, an inordinate drive to succeed. With perseverance and hard work, they all essentially made themselves leaders by enhancing and developing the qualities they were given. All four men were recognized as leaders long before they reached the presidency. And like rocks in a polishing cylinder, all four were brought to shine by tumbling contact with a wide variety of people. They had found their vocation in politics, I have often thought, American philosopher William James wrote of the mysterious formation of identity, that the best way to define a man's character would be to seek out the particular mental or moral attitude in which, when it came upon him, he felt himself most deeply and intensely alive and active. At such moments, there is a voice inside which speaks and says, "This is the real me." Dramatic reversals that shattered the public and private lives of all four men are the subject of Part 2. They were at different life stages when forced to deal with events that rupture their sense of self and threaten to curtail their prospects. The nature of the adversity that assailed each was unique. Abraham Lincoln suffered a blow to his public reputation and his private sense of honor that led to a near-suicidal depression. Theodore Roosevelt lost his young wife and his mother on the same day. Franklin Roosevelt was struck by polio and left permanently paralyzed from the waist down. Lyndon Johnson lost an election to the United States Senate. To draw an analogy between an election loss and the tragic reversals experienced by the others would appear, on the surface, ludicrous. But Lyndon Johnson construed rejection by the people as a judgment upon and a repudiation of his deepest self. For a long while, the election loss negatively changed the direction of his career until a massive heart attack and the proximity of death repurposed his life. Scholars who have studied the development of leaders have situated resilience, the ability to sustain ambition in the face of frustration, at the heart of potential leadership growth. More important than what happened to them was how they responded to these reversals, how they managed in various ways to put themselves back together, how these watershed experiences at first impeded, then deepened, and finally and decisively molded their leadership. Part 3 will bring the four men to the White House. There, at their formidable best, when guided by a sense of moral purpose, they were able to channel their ambitions and summon their talents to enlarge the opportunities and lives of others. Specific stories of how they led will explore the riddle: do leaders shape the times, or do the times summon their leaders? "If there is not the war," Theodore Roosevelt mused, "you don't get the great general. If there is not a great occasion, you don't get the great statesman. If Lincoln had lived in times of peace, no one would have known his name now." Roosevelt's debatable notions voice opinions heard from the beginning of our country. It is not in the still calm of life or the repose of a Pacific station that great characters are formed, Abigail Adams wrote to her son John Quincy Adams in the midst of the American Revolution, suggesting that the habits of a vigorous mind are formed in contending with difficulties. Great necessities call out great virtues. The four leaders presented in this book confronted great necessities. All took office at moments of uncertainty and dislocation in extremis. Abraham Lincoln entered the presidency at the gravest moment of disillusion in American history. Franklin Roosevelt encountered a decisive crisis of confidence in our country's economic survival and the viability of democracy itself. Though neither Theodore Roosevelt nor Lyndon Johnson faced a national crisis on the scale of secession or devastating economic depression, they both assumed office as a result of an assassination, a violent rupture of the democratic mode of succession, at a time when seismic tremors had begun to rattle the social order. While the nature of the era a leader chances to occupy profoundly influences the nature of the leadership opportunity, the leader must be ready when that opportunity presents itself. One leader's skills, strengths, and style may be suited for the times, those of another less so. President James Buchanan was temperamentally unfit to respond to the intensifying crisis over slavery that would confront Abraham Lincoln. President William McKinley encountered the same tumultuous era as Theodore Roosevelt, but failed to grasp the hidden dangers in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. President Herbert Hoover's fixed mindset could not handle the deepening depression with the creativity of Franklin Roosevelt's freewheeling experimentation. President John Kennedy lacked the unrivaled legislative skill and focus that Lyndon Johnson brought to the central issue of the time, civil rights. Rarely was man so fitted to the event, observed philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson, when eulogizing Abraham Lincoln at the Church of the First Parish in Concord, Massachusetts. One would be hard put to invent a leader who could have better guided us through the darkest days of the Civil War, a leader both merciful and merciless, confident and humble, patient and persistent, able to mediate among factions, sustain our spirits, and translate the meaning of the struggle into words of matchless force, clarity, and beauty. Yet, a similar statement might be made of Theodore Roosevelt, whose spirited combativeness was perfectly fitted to the task of mobilizing the country and the press to deal with voracious monopolies and the inequities of the industrial age. We could say the same of Franklin Roosevelt, whose confidence and infectious optimism restored the hope and earned the trust of the American people through both the Great Depression and World War II, or of Lyndon Johnson, whose Southern roots and legislative wizardry ideally fitted him for the great civil rights struggle that altered the face of the country. Four case studies will reveal these vastly different men in action during defining events of their times and presidencies. These four extended examples show how their leadership fit the historical moment as a key fits a lock. No key is exactly the same. Each has a different line of ridges and notches along its blade. While there is neither a master key to leadership nor a common lock of historical circumstance, we can detect a certain family resemblance of leadership traits as we trace the alignment of leadership capacity within its historical context. There is little question that the first three leaders studied here, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt, rank among our greatest presidents. Despite flawed decisions and mistaken judgments, all have been accorded a stable and honored place in communal memory. The case of Lyndon Johnson is more problematic. I have wrestled with his place in history since the days when I worked with him in the White House as a 24-year-old White House fellow. That White House fellowship nearly came to an unceremonious end before it had even gotten started. Like many young people in my generation, I had been active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. Several months before my selection, a fellow graduate student and I had written an article, which we sent to the New Republic, calling for a third-party candidate to challenge Lyndon Johnson in 1968. The New Republic published the article days after my selection as a fellow had been announced. I was certain I would be dismissed from the program. But surprisingly, President Johnson said, "Oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can." I stayed on after the fellowship, and when his presidency was over, accompanied him to the Texas ranch to assist him with his memoirs. While Johnson's conduct during the war will continue to tarnish his legacy, the passing years have made clear that his leadership in civil rights and his domestic vision in the great society will stand the test of time. Lyndon Johnson entered Congress as a protege of Franklin Roosevelt. From his desk in the Oval Office, Johnson gazed directly across to a painting of his political daddy, whose domestic agenda in the New Deal he sought to surpass with his own great society. As a young man, Franklin Roosevelt had daydreamed of his own political ascent, molded step by step upon the career of Theodore Roosevelt. From childhood, Theodore Roosevelt's great hero was Abraham Lincoln, whose patient resolve and freedom from vindictiveness blazed a trail that Theodore Roosevelt sought to follow all his life. And for Abraham Lincoln, the closest he found to an ideal leader was George Washington, whom he invoked when he bade farewell to his home in 1861, drawing strength from the first president as he left Illinois to assume a task greater than that which rested upon Washington. If George Washington was the father of his country, then by affiliation and affinity, Abraham Lincoln was his prodigious son. These four men form a family tree, a lineage of leadership that spans the entirety of our country's history. It is my hope that these stories of leadership in times of fracture and fear will prove instructive and reassuring. These men set a standard and a bar for all of us. Just as they learned from one another, so we can learn from them, and from them gain a better perspective on the discord of our times. for leadership does not exist in a void. Leadership is a two-way street. I have only been an instrument, Lincoln insisted, with both accuracy and modesty. The anti-slavery people of the country and the army have done it all. The progressive movement helped pave the way for Theodore Roosevelt's square deal, much as the civil rights movement provided the fuel to ignite the righteous and pragmatic activism that enabled the Great Society. And no one communicated with people and heard their voices more clearly than Franklin Roosevelt. He absorbed their stories, listened carefully, and for a generation held a non-stop conversation with the people. With public sentiment, nothing can fail, Abraham Lincoln said. Without it, nothing can succeed. Such a leader is inseparably linked to the people. Such leadership is a mirror in which the people see their collective reflection. Part 1. Ambition and the Recognition of Leadership.
Chapter 1. Abraham. Every man is said to have his peculiar ambition. Lincoln was only 23 years old on March 9, 1832, when he declared his intention to run for a seat in the Illinois state legislature. The frontier state had not yet developed party machinery to officially nominate candidates. Persons desiring to run simply put forward their own names on a handbill, expressing their views on local affairs. Every man is said to have his peculiar ambition, Lincoln began. I have no other so great as that of being truly esteemed of my fellow men, by rendering myself worthy of their esteem. How far I shall succeed in gratifying this ambition has yet to be developed. I am young and unknown to many of you. For many ambitious young men in the 19th century, politics proved the chosen arena for advancement. While Lincoln's ambition was as central to his makeup as his backbone, it was almost from the start twofold. It was not simply for himself. It was for the people he hoped to lead. He wanted to distinguish himself in their eyes. The sense of community was central to the master dream of his life, the desire to accomplish deeds that would gain the lasting respect of his fellow men. He asked for the opportunity to render himself worthy. I was born and have ever remained in the most humble walks of life. I have no wealthy or popular relations to recommend me. If the good people in their wisdom shall see fit to keep me in the background, I have been too familiar with disappointments to be very much chagrined. Where did this ambition come from? His strong conviction, as one friend described it, that he was born for better things than seemed likely or even possible. When asked later to shed light on his beginnings, Lincoln claimed the story could be condensed into a single sentence, the short and simple annals of the poor. His father, Thomas, had never learned to read, and according to his son, never did more in the way of writing than to bunglingly sign his own name. Trapped in an exitless poverty, Thomas cleared only sufficient land for survival and moved from one dirt farm to another in Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois. While traces of the life of Lincoln's mother, Nancy Hanks, are sketchy, those who knew her agreed. She was superior to her husband in every way. She was described as keen, shrewd, smart, endowed with a strong memory and quick perception. All that I am or hope ever to be, I get from my mother, Lincoln later said. When Abraham was 9, Nancy Hanks died from what was known as milk sickness, a disease transmitted by way of cows that had eaten poisonous plants. After her burial, Thomas abandoned his young son and his 12-year-old daughter, Sarah, for a period of 7 months while he returned to Kentucky to find a new wife. They were left on their own in what Lincoln described as a wild region, a nightmarish place where the panther's scream filled the night with fear and bears preyed on the swine. When Abraham's new stepmother, Sarah Bush Johnston, returned with Thomas, she found the children living like animals, wild, ragged, and dirty. She was stunned to find that the floorless cabin lacked even a door. Inside, there were few furnishings, no beds and scant bedding. From the store of goods she had brought with her in the wagon, the industrious Sarah created a snug and comfortable home. A floor was laid, door and windows hung, and she provided clothing for the children. How, within the confines of this desolation, did Lincoln develop and sustain a grand, visionary ambition, a belief that he was meant for higher and better things? The springboard to the development of Lincoln's ambition can be traced to his recognition, even as a young boy, that he was gifted with an exceptionally intelligent, clear, and inquisitive mind. Schoolmates in the ABC school in rural Kentucky, where he was taught to read and write at the age of 7, recalled that he was able to learn more swiftly and understand more deeply than others. Though he was able to attend school only sporadically, when his father didn't require his labor on the hardscrabble farm, he stood without peer at the top of every class. "He was a learned boy among us unlearned folks," one classmate recalled. He carried away from his brief schooling, his biographer, David Herbert Donald, observes, the self-confidence of a man who has never met his intellectual equal. A dream that he might someday be in a situation to make the most of his talents began to take hold. In the age-old debate about whether leadership traits are innate or developed, memory, the ease and capacity with which the mind stores information, is generally considered an inborn trait. From his earliest days in school, Lincoln's comrades remarked upon his phenomenal memory, the best, the most marvelously retentive they had ever encountered. His mind seemed a wonder, a friend told him. Impressions were easily made upon it and never effaced. Lincoln told his friend he was mistaken. What appeared a gift, he argued, was, in his case, a developed talent. "I'm slow to learn," he explained, "and slow to forget what I have learned. My mind is like a piece of steel, very hard to scratch anything on it, and almost impossible after you get it there to rub it out." His stepmother, who came to love him as if he were her own son, observed the arduous process by which he engraved things into his memory. When he came upon a passage that struck him, he would write it down on boards if he had no paper, and keep it there until he did get paper, she recalled. And then he would rewrite it and keep it in the scrapbook so that he could preserve it. While his mind was neither quick nor facile, young Lincoln possessed singular powers of reasoning and comprehension, unflagging curiosity, and a fierce, almost irresistible compulsion to understand the meaning of what he heard, read, or was taught. "When a mere child," Lincoln later said, "I used to get irritated when anybody talked to me in a way I could not understand. I do not think I ever got angry at anything else in my life. When he got on a hunt for an idea, he could not sleep until he caught it, and even then was not able to rest until he had bounded it north and bounded it south and bounded it east and bounded it west." Early on, Abraham revealed a keystone attribute essential to success in any field: the motivation and willpower to develop every talent he possessed to the fullest. "The ambition of the man soared above us," his childhood friend Nathaniel Grigsby recalled. "He read and thoroughly read his books whilst we played. When he first learned how to print the letters of the alphabet, he was so excited that he formed letters, words, and sentences wherever he found suitable material. He scrawled them in charcoal. He scored them in the dust, in the sand, in the snow. Anywhere and everywhere that lines could be drawn. He soon became the best penman in the neighborhood." Sharing his knowledge with his schoolmates at every turn, he soon became their guide and leader. A friend recalled the great pains he took to explain to her the movements of the heavenly bodies, patiently telling her that the moon was not really sinking, as she initially thought. It was the earth that was moving, not the moon. "When he appeared in company," another friend recalled, "the boys would gather and cluster around him to hear him talk. with kindness, playfulness, wit, and wisdom. He would explain, "Dying's hard for us to understand by stories, maxims, tales, and figures." He would almost always point his lesson or idea by some story that was plain and near as that we might instantly see the force and bearing of what he said. He understood early on that concrete examples and stories provided the best vehicles for teaching. He had developed his talent for storytelling in part from watching his father. Though Thomas Lincoln was unable to read or write, he possessed wit, a talent for mimicry, and an uncanny memory for exceptional stories. Night after night, Thomas would exchange tales with farmers, carpenters, and peddlers as they passed along the old Cumberland Trail. Young Lincoln sat spellbound in the corner. After listening to the adults' chatter through the evening, Abraham would spend no small part of the night walking up and down, attempting to figure out what they were saying. No small part of his motivation was to entertain his friends the next day with a simplified and riotous version of the arcane adult world. He thrived when holding forth on a tree stump or log, captivating the appreciative attention of his young audience, and before long had built a repertoire of stories and great storytelling skills. At the age of 10, a relative recalled Abraham learned to mimic the style and tone of the itinerant Baptist preachers who appeared irregularly in the region. To the delight of his friends, he could reproduce their rip-roaring sermons almost word for word, complete with gestures of head and hand to emphasize emotion. Then, as he got older, he found additional material for his storytelling by walking 15 miles to the nearest courthouse, where he soaked up the narratives of criminal trials, contract disputes, and contested wills, and then retold the cases in lurid detail. His stories often had a point, a moral along the lines of one of his favorite books, Aesop's Fables. But sometimes they were simply funny tales that he had heard and would retell with animation. When he began to speak, his face, the natural contours of which gave off a sorrowful aspect, would light up with a transforming, winning smile. And when he reached the end of his story, he would laugh with such heartiness that soon everyone was laughing with him. Not all his humorous gifts were filled with gentle hilarity, and he would learn to muzzle his more caustic and mocking rejoinders. An early case in point was one Josiah Crawford, who had lent Lincoln his copy of Parson Weems' Life of Washington. During a severe rainstorm, the book was damaged. Crawford demanded that Lincoln repay the value of the book by working 2 full days pulling corn. Lincoln considered this unfair, but nonetheless set to work until there was not a corn blade left on a stalk. Later, however, he wrote a verse lampooning Crawford's unusually large, ugly nose, reciting Josiah blowing his bugle for the entertainment of his friends. If he was the hub of his young circle's entertainment, he was also their foremost contrarian, willing to face their disapproval rather than abandon what he considered right. The boys in the neighborhood, one schoolmate recollected, liked to play a game of catching turtles and putting hot coals on their backs to see them wiggle. Abe not only told them it was wrong, he wrote a short essay in school against cruelty to animals. Nor did Lincoln feel compelled to share in the folkways of the frontier, a harsh culture in which children learned, for survival and for sport, to shoot and kill birds and animals. After killing a wild turkey with his father's rifle when he was 8 years old, he never again pulled a trigger on any larger game. These attitudes were not merely moral postures. The young boy possessed a profound sense of empathy, the ability to put himself in the place of others, to imagine their situations and identify with their feelings. One winter night, a friend remembered he and Abraham were walking home when they saw something lying in a mud hole. It was a man. He was dead drunk and nearly frozen. Abe picked him up and carried him all the way to his cousin's house, where he built a fire to warm him up. On another occasion, when Lincoln was walking with a group of friends, he passed a pig caught in a stretch of boggy ground. The group continued on for a half a mile when Lincoln suddenly stopped. He insisted on turning back to rescue the pig. He couldn't bear the pain he felt in his own mind when he thought of the pig. Lincoln's size and strength bolstered his authority with his peers. From an early age, he was more athletic than most of the boys in the neighborhood, ready to outrun, outjump, and outwrestle, or outlift anybody. As a young man, one friend reported, he could carry what three ordinary men would grunt and sweat at. Blessed with uncommon strength, he was also favored with robust health. Relatives recalled that he was never sick. Lincoln's physical dominance proved a double-edged sword, however, for he was expected, from the age of 8 to the age of 21, to accompany his father into the fields, wielding an axe, felling trees, digging up stumps, splitting rails, plowing, and planting. His father considered that bones and muscles were sufficient to make a man, and then time in school was doubly wasted. In rural areas, the only schools were subscription schools, so it not only cost a family money to give a child an education, but the classroom took the child away from manual labor. Accordingly, when Lincoln reached the age of 9 or 10, his own formal education was cut short. Left on his own, Abraham had to educate himself. He had to take the initiative, assume responsibility for securing books, decide what to study, become his own teacher. He made things happen instead of waiting for them to happen. Gaining access to reading material proved nearly insurmountable. Relatives and neighbors recalled that Lincoln scoured the countryside to borrow books and read every volume he could lay his hands on. A book was his steadfast companion. Every respite from the daily manual tasks was a time to read a page or two from Pilgrim's Progress or Aesop's Fables, pausing while resting his horse at the end of a long row of planting. Some leaders learn by writing, others by reading, still others by listening. Lincoln preferred reading aloud in the presence of others. "When I read aloud," Lincoln later explained, "two senses catch the idea. First, I see what I read. Second, I hear it, and therefore I remember it better." Early on, he possessed a vivid sensibility for the music and rhythm of poetry and drama. He recited long stanzas and passages from memory. When the time came to return the borrowed books, he had made them his own. As he explored literature and the history of the country, the young Lincoln, already conscious of his own powers, began to imagine ways of living beyond those of his family and neighbors. When his father found his son in the field reading a book, or worse still, distracting fellow workers with tales or passages from one of his books, he would angrily break up the performance so work might continue. On occasion, he would go so far as to destroy Abraham's books and whip him for neglecting his labors. To Thomas, Abraham's chronic reading was tantamount to dereliction, a mark of laziness. He thought his son was deceiving himself with his quest for education. "I tried to stop it, but he has got that fool idea into his head, and it can't be got out," Thomas told a friend. At times, when the tensions with his father seemed unbearable, when the gap between his lofty ambitions and the reality of his circumstances seemed too great to bridge, Lincoln was engulfed by sadness, revealing a pensive, melancholy side to his temperament that became more pronounced as time went by. "His melancholy dripped from him as he walked," said his junior law partner, William Herndon, an observation echoed by dozens of others. "No element of Mr. Lincoln's character was so marked," recalled his friend Henry Clay Whitney, "as his mysterious and profound melancholy. Yet if melancholy was part of his nature, so too was the life-affirming humor that allowed him to perceive what was funny or ludicrous in life, lightening his despair and fortifying his will. Both Lincoln's storytelling and his humor, friends believed, were necessary to his very existence. They were intended to whistle off sadness." In the end, the unending strain with his father enhanced rather than diminished young Lincoln's ambition. Year after year, as he persevered in defiance of his father's wishes, managing his negative emotions and exercising his will to slowly master one subject after another, He developed an increasing belief in his own strengths and powers. He came to trust that he was going to be something, his cousin Sophie Hanks related, slowly creating what one leadership scholar calls a vision of an alternative future. He told a neighbor he did not intend to delve, grub, shuck corn, split rails, and the like. I'll study and get ready, and then the chance will come. Opportunity arrived the moment he reached 21, the age of majority, releasing him from his near-indentured lot in his father's home. Seeing no prospect of betterment in his condition, so long as his fortune was interwoven with that of his father, one friend recalled him saying, he at last endeavored to strike out into the broad world. Bundling his sparse possessions on his shoulders, he headed west, walking more than 100 miles to reach New Salem, where he had been promised a job as a clerk and bookkeeper in a general store. A bustling small town recently sprung up along the Sangamon River, New Salem boasted a grist mill that supplied a large section of the county with its meal, flour, and lumber. The entire settlement consisted of a few hundred people, 15 log cabins, a tavern, a church, a blacksmith, a schoolmaster, a preacher, and a general store. To the villagers of New Salem, the tall, young stranger struck them as odd and unappealing, gawky and rough-looking, with dark, weathered skin, great ears, high cheekbones, and black, quill-like hair. He was dressed in the most ludicrous character. His long arms protruded through the sleeves of a coat, and his pantaloons were far better adapted for a man of much less height, which left exposed a pair of socks. From this unprepossessing start, how was Lincoln able to establish himself so quickly in the minds of the residents that within 8 months they encouraged him to run for a seat in the state legislature? The answer, one local man explained, lay in Lincoln's sociability, his open, candid, obliging and honest good nature. Everybody loved him. He would help travelers whose carriages were mired in mud. He volunteered to chop wood for widows. He was ever ready to lend a spontaneous, unobtrusive hand. Almost anyone who had contact with him in the little community spoke of his kindness, generosity, intelligence, humor, humility, and a striking, original character. Rather than golden myth-making tales spun in the wake of Lincoln's historic presidency, these stories, told by the score, join into a chorus of the New Salem community to form an authentic portrait of a singular young man. Working as a clerk in New Salem's general store provided Lincoln with an ideal foundation upon which to build his political career. The general store filled a unique place on the frontier. Beyond the sale of groceries, hardware, cloth, and bonnets, the village store provided a kind of intellectual and social center, a place where villagers gathered to read the newspaper, discuss the local sporting contest, and mainly argue about politics in an era when politics was a consuming, almost universal concern. For the farmers, who might ride 50 miles to grind grain into flour at the village grist mill, the store offered a common meeting place to unwind, exchange opinions, share stories. Within weeks, a fellow clerk recalled Lincoln's gregarious nature and cornucopia of funny stories had made him a center of attraction. The townspeople regarded him as among the best clerks they had ever seen. He was attentive to his business, one villager remembered, was kind and considerate to his customers and friends, and always treated them with great tenderness. At the same time, his unabashed eagerness to learn deeply impressed the people of New Salem. A volume of poetry or a book of prose was always kept behind the counter so he could read during a lull in the general store's business. In discussions about politics, he revealed an intimate familiarity with the issues of the day. Clearly, this was no ordinary clerk. The local families were attracted by his reflective, gentle, meditative temperament. They wanted him to prosper. They felt part of his upward climb. They lent him books. The village cooper kept a fire of shaving sufficiently bright so that Lincoln could come into his place at night and read. When he was ignorant on any subject, one friend recalled, no matter how simple it might make him appear. He was always willing to acknowledge it. When he told the schoolmaster he had never studied grammar and wanted to do so, the schoolmaster agreed that if he ever wanted to speak in public, this was something he had to learn. While no one in New Salem had a proper grammar text, the schoolmaster knew of a volume in a house 6 miles away. Lincoln rose from the table and started out on foot to procure the book. Returning with a treasured copy of Kirkham's English Grammar, he began at once to sort through the complicated rules governing the structure of sentences and the use of adverbs and adjectives. He worked hard to develop a simple, compact style of speaking and writing, with short, clear sentences that could be understood by all classes. The handbill Lincoln published announcing his candidacy stretched to 2,000 words. Clearly, he labored over the statement to let people know how he stood on public issues and to declare something of his nature and character. He ran as a member of the Whig Party, in a county that was predominantly Democratic. He stood for 4 central ideas: the creation of a national bank, protective tariffs, governmental support for internal improvements, and an expanded system of public education. A state representative could do little to promote national banking or high tariffs. The call for public education and for infrastructure projects to improve roads, rivers, harbors, and railways was not simply a matter of Whig boilerplate, however, but an expression of deeply urgent needs involving his own aspirations and those of his little community. The Sangamon River was New Salem's lifeline. Upon it, settlers sent their produce to market and received necessary goods. Unless the obstacles to its navigability were surmounted, unless channels could be dredged and drifting logs removed, New Salem would never develop into a full-fledged community. The previous year, Lincoln had piloted a flatboat on the river, gaining first-hand knowledge. He spoke with competence and confidence about a subject closely entwined with his own ambitions. If rivers and roads could be improved, if the government could aid in economic growth and development, hundreds of small hamlets like New Salem would thrive. If elected, Lincoln pledged, any law providing dependable roads and navigable streams for the poorest and most thinly populated communities shall receive my support. On the topic of education, he declared, I can only say that I view it as the most important subject which we as a people can be engaged in. He wanted every man to read the history of his country, to appreciate the value of our free institutions, to treasure literature and the scriptures. Lincoln spoke of education with the passion of a young man who had made ferocious efforts to educate himself in the hope of building a bridge between the humble walks of life and his dreams of an expansive future. The education he continued to seek for himself was one he wanted available for every man. In his first foray into politics, Lincoln also pledged that if his opinions on any subject turned out to be erroneous, he stood ready to renounce them. With his commitment, Lincoln revealed early on a quality that would characterize his leadership for the rest of his life, a willingness to acknowledge errors and learn from his mistakes. The pact Lincoln offered the people, the promise of unremitting labor in return for their support, was for him a covenant. The business of a vote or an election expressed a bond of affection that united people together. It was a question of trust. From the start, the destiny he sought was no simple craving for individual fame and distinction. His ambitions were first and always linked with the people. While uncertain about his prospects in this first election, Lincoln made it clear that failure did not intimidate him. Should he lose, he had said when declaring his intention to run, he had been too familiar with disappointments to be very much chagrined. And yet he forewarned, only after being defeated some 5 or 6 times, would he deem it a disgrace and be certain never to try it again. So, along with the uncertainty of whether his ambition would be realized, was the promise of resilience. His campaign had scarcely begun when he volunteered to join the Illinois militia to fight against the Sac and Fox Indians during what became known as the Black Hawk War. To his surprise, he later said, he was elected captain of his company. No later success in life, he told a journalist a month after he'd been nominated for president, had provided him so much satisfaction. When he returned to New Salem after 3 months of service, he had only 4 weeks to campaign before the August election. Traveling by horseback across a sparsely populated county the size of Rhode Island, Lincoln spoke at country stores and small village squares. On Saturdays, he joined his fellow candidates in the largest towns, where farmers gathered at auctions. Vendues, to dispose of produce, buy supplies, see their neighbors, and get the news. The speaking would start mid-morning and last until sunset. Each candidate was given a turn. Lincoln, one contender recalled, did not follow the beaten track of other speakers. He set himself apart by the candid way in which he approached every question and by his habit of illustrating his arguments with stories based on observations drawn from all classes of society between men and women in their daily lives. At times his language was awkward, as were his gestures, but few who heard him speak ever forgot either the argument of the story itself, or the author. When the votes were counted, Lincoln found he had lost the election. His lack of success, however, did not dampen his hopes nor sour his ambition, a friend recalled. On the contrary, he gained confidence from the knowledge that in his own town of New Salem, he had received an overwhelming total of 277 of the 300 votes cast. After the election, Lincoln worked several jobs to procure bread and keep body and soul together. He served as New Salem's postmaster. And then, after teaching himself the principles of geometry and trigonometry involved in determining boundaries of land parcels, he was appointed deputy surveyor for Sangamon County, a position that allowed him to travel from one village to another. So swiftly did his reputation for storytelling precede him, a friend of Lincoln's recalled, that no sooner had he arrived in a village than men and boys gathered from far and near, ready to carry chains, drive stakes, and blaze trees, if they could hear Lincoln's odd stories and jokes. In 1834, now 25, he ran for the state legislature once again, making good on his serial comic warning that he would keep trying a half dozen times before giving up. Once again, he traversed the district on horseback, delivering speeches, shaking hands, introducing himself, joining in local activities. Seeing 30 men in the field during a harvest, he offered to help, taking hold of the scythe with perfect ease, thereby winning every vote in the crowd. His ungainly appearance initially put people off. "Can't the party raise a better candidate than that?" a doctor asked upon first seeing Lincoln. Then, after hearing him talk, he changed his mind. "Why, he knows more than all of them put together." This time, having expanded his contacts throughout the county, Lincoln easily won. As he prepared to leave for the capital to take up his seat in the legislature, his friends chipped in to help him buy suitable clothing that would allow him to maintain his new dignity. They recognized a leader in their midst, just as surely as he had begun to feel the makings of a leader within himself. The rookie assemblyman was, in the words of his friend William Herndon, anything but conspicuous during the opening session of the state legislature. He remained quietly in the background, patiently educating himself about how the assembly operated, acquainting himself with the intricacies of parliamentary procedure. He carefully monitored debates and discerned the ideological rifts between his fellow Whigs and the Democrats. Aware that he was in the presence of an unusually talented group of legislators, including two future presidential candidates, six future United States senators, eight future congressmen, and three state Supreme Court justices, Lincoln was neither bashful nor timid. He was simply paying close attention, absorbing, readying to act as soon as he had accumulated sufficient knowledge to do so. A finely developed sense of timing, knowing when to wait and when to act, would remain in Lincoln's repertoire of leadership skills the rest of his life. Between legislative sessions, Lincoln began to read law, knowing that a legal education would nourish his political career. An autodidact by necessity, he studied with nobody, he later said, poring over cases and precedents deep into the night after working long days as surveyor and postal clerk. He borrowed law books, one at a time, from the set of John Stewart, a fellow legislator who had a law practice in Springfield. After finishing each book, he would hike the 20 miles from New Salem to Springfield to secure another loaner. An unwavering purpose supported him. "Get the books and read and study them," he told a law student seeking advice 2 decades later. "Always bear in mind that your own resolution to succeed is more important than any other one thing." At the commencement of the second session, the transformation of Lincoln's demeanor and activity was clear. He was suddenly conspicuous, as if something in him had awakened. So thoroughly had he mastered both the legalese required for writing legislation and the intricacies of parliamentary procedure that his colleagues called on him to draft bills and amendments. The clear, legible handwriting he had perfected as a child proved invaluable when public laws and documents were initially written in longhand. More importantly, when he finally rose to speak on the assembly floor, his colleagues witnessed what the citizens of New Salem had already seen, a young man with a remarkable array of oratorical gifts. "They say I tell a great many stories," Lincoln told a friend. "I reckon I do. But I have learnt from my long experience that plain people, take them as they run, are more easily influenced through the medium of a broad and humorous illustration than any other way." As people read his speeches in the newspapers or heard about his lively metaphors and analogies through word of mouth, awareness of Lincoln's signal ability to communicate spread throughout the state. Heralded for his leadership in moving the state capital from Vandalia to Springfield, Lincoln, the second youngest member of the assembly, was selected by the full Whig caucus as their minority leader. Their choice signified not only their deference to Lincoln's language skills and his mastery of parliamentary procedure, but what became known as his crowning gift of political diagnosis, his ability to intuit the feelings and intentions of his fellow Whigs and the opposing Democrats as well. After silently considering his colleagues' strategy and opinions, he would stand and simply say, "From your talk, I gather the Democrats will do so-and-so. If we want to checkmate them, here are the maneuvers we should take in the days that follow." So clear was his recommended course of action that his listeners wondered why they had not seen it that way themselves. It was his thorough knowledge of human nature, one fellow legislator observed, that made him an overmatch for his compeers and for any man that I have ever known. "We followed his lead," a Whig colleague recalled. "But he followed nobody's lead. He hewed the way for us to follow, and we gladly did so. He could grasp and concentrate the matters under discussion, and his clear statement of an intricate or obscure subject was better than an ordinary argument." Democrats, of course, felt otherwise. How Lincoln responded to attacks directed against him and his party reveals much about his temperament and the character of his developing leadership. Such was the lure of politics in the antebellum era that discussions and debates between Whigs and Democrats regularly attracted the fanatic attention of hundreds of people. Opponents attacked each other in fiery, abusive language, much to the delight of raucous audiences, inciting an atmosphere that could burst into fistfights, even, on occasion, guns being drawn. While Lincoln was as thin-skinned and prickly as most politicians, his retorts were generally full of such good-humored raillery that members of both parties could not help but laugh and relax in the pleasure of his entertaining and well-told stories. So memorable were several of Lincoln's counterattacks that citizens could recite them afterward word for word. The lightning rod episode is a case in point. A crowd was beginning to disperse from a spirited rally at which Lincoln had spoken, when George Forquer stood up, a prominent Whig who had recently shifted to the Democratic Party After receiving a lucrative appointment as land register, Forquer had lately built a fancy house, complete with a newfangled lightning rod. Standing on the stage, Forquer declared that it was time for someone to take young Lincoln down, which he attempted to do with ridicule. Though the attack had roused the lion within him, Lincoln remained quiet until Forquer finished, silently preparing his rejoinder. "The gentleman commenced by saying the young man would have to be taken down," Lincoln began, drolly admitting. "I desire to live, and I desire place and distinction. But I would rather die now than, like the gentleman, live to see the day I would change my politics for an office worth $3,000 a year, and then feel compelled to erect a lightning rod to protect a guilty conscience from an offended God." The outburst of laughter provoked from the audience was thunderous. On certain occasions, however, Herndon recalled, Lincoln's humor ran amok, his light mockery turning vindictive, even cruel. After Democrat Jesse Thomas had indulged in some fun at Lincoln's expense, Lincoln displayed an aspect of his great theatrical skill, resorting to mimicry, at which he had no rival. He imitated Thomas in gesture and voice, at times caricaturing his walk and the very motion of his body. As the crowd responded with yells and cheers, Lincoln gave way to intense and scathing ridicule, mocking still further the ludicrous way Thomas spoke. Seated in the audience, Thomas broke down in tears, and soon the skinning of Thomas became the talk of the town. Realizing he had badly overstepped, Lincoln went to Thomas and gave him a heartfelt apology. And for years afterward, the memory of that night filled Lincoln with the deepest chagrin. Increasingly, though not always, he was able to rein in his impulse to throw a hurtful counterpunch. He was after something more significant than the gratification of an artfully delivered humiliation. Even early on, Lincoln's moral courage and convictions outweighed his ferocious ambition. At the age of 26, he made a public statement on slavery that threatened to drastically diminish his support in a state that was then largely settled by Southerners. The rise of abolitionism in the Northeast, coupled with the refusal of some northern states to return fugitive slaves, had led legislatures in both South and North to pass resolutions confirming the constitutional right to slavery. The General Assembly in Illinois fell in line. By the disproportionate vote of 77-6, the Assembly resolved that "we highly disapprove of the formation of abolition societies and hold sacred the right to property in slaves." Lincoln was among the six who voted no. Registering a formal protest, he proclaimed that "the institution of slavery is founded on both injustice and bad policy." He had always believed, he later said, that if slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. Lincoln's protest stopped well short of abolitionism. Until such time as the Constitution empowered Congress to eliminate slavery, he felt that his hands were tied against interfering where slavery was already established. Fearing anarchy, above all, he believed it essential to abide by a law until that settled law be lawfully changed. Though carefully worded and pruned of any offensive allusions, the protest was nonetheless, writer William Stoddard observed, a bold thing to do, and a day when to be an anti-slavery man, even at the North, was to be a sort of social outcast and political pariah. Remaining true to his original promise to do everything he could to secure governmental aid for infrastructure improvements, however, was more personal and pressing to Lincoln in these early years of his political career than the issue of slavery. He used the power of his leading position in the Assembly to mobilize support behind a series of bills authorizing millions of dollars for a spectacular range of projects to widen rivers, build railroads, dig canals, and create roads. From prairie and first-growth forest, from clogged creeks and rivers, from black earth perfect for farming but untenable for road and train beds during the spring melts and fall rains, Lincoln envisioned a massive infrastructure system. Drawn from his first-hand knowledge of the land, his plan would provide the vital connectors to create a circulatory system of people and their products, a living social body necessary to build and sustain a growing economy. His dream, he told a friend, was to be known as the DeWitt Clinton of Illinois, invoking the celebrated governor of New York, who had vastly spurred economic development and left a lasting imprint on his state when he secured legislation to support the building of the Erie Canal. In like fashion, Lincoln hoped that with the completion of these projects, markets would develop, bustling towns would spring up, living standards would rise, new settlers would come, greater opportunities would open for more people. Those born in the lower ranks would rise as far as their talents and discipline might take them, and the promise of the American dream would be realized. When a sustained recession hit the state in 1837, however, public sentiment began to rear up against such expensive and still unfinished internal improvement projects. As the state debt rose to monumental proportions, Lincoln continued to stoutly defend the infrastructure system against the surge of condemnation, likening the abandonment of the new canal system to stopping a small boat in the middle of a river. If it was not going up, it would go down. To relinquish the program of improvements, he repeatedly warned, would leave behind only failure and debt. Resilted canals, obstructed waterways, half-built roads and bridges. Adamantly, he refused to give ground, abiding by his father's old maxim, "If you make a bad bargain, hug it the tighter." His dogged resistance to abandon the policies he had so passionately advocated seemed to some a sign of stubbornness. But he held fast to his vision, as if his innermost hopes, personal dreams, and ambitions were under direct assault, which was exactly the case. 6 years after first declaring his own peculiar ambition to his new neighbors in New Salem, the 29-year-old Lincoln elaborated on the nature of ambition and the thirst for distinction in an address to the Young Men's Lyceum of Springfield. He opened his address with a warning that something of ill omen was developing among the people, a tendency to substitute violence, murder, and lynching for the rule of law, the courts, and the Constitution. 2 months earlier, the entire North had been rocked when a pro-slavery mob in Alton, Illinois, killed the abolitionist editor Elijah Lovejoy. In Mississippi, a group of Negroes suspected of inciting insurrection were hanged, as were a group of whites suspected of aiding the Negroes. If this mob-like spirit continued to spread, Lincoln cautioned, the good men, men who love tranquility, would become alienated from a government too weak to protect them. The country would then be vulnerable to the imposition of order from above. While the ambition of the hallowed framers had been inseparably linked with building up a constitutional government allowing the people to govern themselves, he feared that in the chaos of mob-like behavior, men of the likes of an Alexander, a Caesar, or a Napoleon would likely seek distinction by boldly setting themselves to the task of pulling down. Such men of towering egos, in whom ambition is divorced from the people's best interests, were not men to lead a democracy. They were despots. To counter the troublesome ambition of such men, Lincoln called upon his fellow Americans to renew the framers' values and to embrace the Constitution and its laws. Let reverence for the laws be breathed by every American mother, taught in every school, preached in every pulpit. The great bulwark against a potential dictator is an informed people, attached to the government and laws. This argument takes Lincoln back to his first statement to the people of Sangamon County, when he spoke of education as the cornerstone of democracy. Why is education so central? Because, as he said then, every citizen must be able to read history to appreciate the value of our free institutions. And reading about the Revolution and the making of the Constitution was more urgent, for time had passed and remembered scenes of the Revolution were fading. Indeed, Lincoln declared that the story of America's birth should be read of and recounted so long as the Bible should be read. The Founding Fathers' noble experiment, their ambition to show the world that ordinary people could govern themselves, had succeeded. And now, Lincoln concluded, it was up to his generation to preserve this proud fabric of freedom. Still in his 20s, Abraham Lincoln had already developed a conception of leadership based upon the leader's shared understanding of his followers' needs for liberty, equality, and opportunity. In less than half a dozen years, seemingly from nothing and from nowhere, he had risen to become a respected leader in the state legislature, a central figure in the fight for internal improvements, an instrumental force behind the planting of the new capital, and a practicing lawyer. Given his beginnings, he had traveled an immense distance. Yet, given the inordinate nature of his ambition to render himself worthy of his fellow men, he had hardly begun.
Chapter 2. Theodore. I rose like a rocket. Theodore Roosevelt, like Abraham Lincoln, was 23 years old when he made his first foray into the political world. But there the similarities end. In Lincoln's rural environment, anyone who wanted to be a candidate could step up and nominate himself, run on his own hook, and speak on his own behalf. Since voters came to encounter candidates firsthand in general stores and village squares, personal impressions mattered more than party affiliation. Lincoln's 2,000-word statement announcing his aspiration for a seat in the state legislature revealed his deepest personal ambitions as well as his stand on local issues. In contrast, Roosevelt's 33-word statement, devoid of promises, pledges, and personality, was a simple acknowledgment of a nomination already secured. Having been nominated as a candidate for member of assembly for this district, I would esteem it a compliment if you would honor me with your vote and personal influence on Election Day. In the half-century span between Lincoln's and Roosevelt's beginnings in public life, the means of entry into politics had radically changed. While Lincoln had stepped forward on his own, young Roosevelt was chosen to run by the local boss, Joe Murray, a burly red-haired Irish immigrant. The 21st Assembly District, where Roosevelt dwelled, embraced both the elegant brownstones along Madison Avenue and the crowded tenements on the west side of Manhattan. Known as the Silk Stocking District, it was one of the few reliably Republican districts in the